Kia ora, everyone. Welcome to Politics in Full Sentences, your thoughtful take on the week's political happenings with a strong lashing of free markets and, most of all, free minds. Joining with me today is the leader of the ACT Party, David Seymour.
G'day.
And it's a privilege to welcome former Finance Minister Ruth Richardson to the studio today. Welcome.
Greetings. Thanks. Great to be here.
Now, I've got a little run sheet about what we're going to talk about. I know, Ruth, you wanted to talk about David as well. First of all, following the run sheet, you want to talk about Fonterra. Now, it's been in the news a little bit. Should it ever have been established, Ruth? First question.
Unequivocally, no. And these were your questions.
Yeah.
Not mine. Unequivocally, no. Fonterra is a fail on two counts. One is it's failed against its own lofty goals. It's sold its shareholders short. It's trashed the share price. It's disgraceful that we take our precious resources and sell them at sort of the lowest common denominator. But the first thing, it's failed its lofty goals, sold its shareholders short. But I think even arguably more damaging, it's failed New Zealand. It sold New Zealand short. We've got this precious resource, land, pasture systems, stewardship of natural resources, water, air, and effectively Fonterra is taking this wonderful high-value premium resource, turning it into a lowest common denominator commodity, and depriving the country of the ability to turn that premium resource into a premium product and sell it for premium prices.
Ruth, you know, one of the things, you know, Joe Public generally sees Fonterra as a great company, good branding, good image. I mean, how was it actually set up? I know David had, you know, briefly mentioned this to me earlier. I'd love to know a bit more so that the average bloke voting out there, or bloke or lady that wants to understand this a little bit more, would love to know how did Fonterra come about?
Oh, well, I can do this one.
Okay.
Look, I mean, basically, you know, to have a monopoly of that scale would normally be illegal. You know, we have competition laws in this country. And what happened is a group of good old mostly boys got together, and this is why I really don't like it. It was cringy. It was cultural cringe. It was the thought that we New Zealanders can have a really big company that will go and sock it to the others on the world stage. And of course, that's really great if you have a successful company that really is doing innovative stuff and grows up and competes. And that's what one of the things ACT stands for, one of the things we want. But when you require an Act of Parliament to establish it in the first place, and that was required, the Dairy Industry Restructuring Act, to actually circumvent the normal competition laws and make it possible, that's never going to be a good start, because it was always going to be inherently a product of politics. And as we always say, you know, you don't get rich through politics. Well, some people do, but that's called corruption.
Some of the moves of Fonterra, particularly, you know, I'm even speaking with Waikato Chamber of Commerce CEO Chris Simpson, said, you know, the move out of Waikato to come into Auckland City just seemed like, you know, it's a corporate.
And Chris used to work with Ruth, and there's not a conspiracy here.
To go to its origins, the Commerce Commission said no. And there were 58 reasons they had to give in order to overcome those hurdles. So they basically ripped up the Commerce Commission draft determination. They went running to Helen Clark, who said, oh, yes, you'll be the national champion. Yeah, right. And every single party in Parliament voted for it, except to their huge credit, ACT.
Okay, that's really interesting. That's great, but what's the alternative?
Oh, the alternative is very clear. So you take two companies listed on both the New Zealand and Australian Stock Exchange. I declare my interest. I'm a director of one, was the first independent director of Synlait Milk. Our share price since we listed has gone up 300%. Fonterra's has dropped by 50%.
Wow.
Or you take the A2 Milk Corporation that Fonterra 20 years ago said to you, it's phony science, don't believe it, get out of here. And A2 Milk Corporation is now vastly more profitable and vastly more valuable than Fonterra would ever be. So you've got the classic corporation, or you've got a hybrid. So Silver Fern Farms, for example, was a cooperative, failed, as Fonterra is failing and as Westland has just failed. So the bankers basically dictated the pace, and they divided up Silver Fern Farms, which was one of the biggest meat companies in New Zealand, into a holding company that the cooperative effectively is maintained, but it has 50% of the ownership of the hybrid. They get rations, but no say. So they're like a holding company of 50%, but the actual operating company is now more in a classic corporate mode. You know, where all the incentives are right, where you know your cost of capital, you don't have vaguely defined property rights, your shareholders are not conscripts.
It's about accountability, really, isn't it?
Well, that's about performance. Yeah. What is the... I think Fonterra is a systemic failure of a business structure, just as protectionism was a systemic failure in trying to create a growing and competitive economy. And until that business structure is addressed, Fonterra will continue to dive. But it's a religion. You know, the religion is... You know, Fonterra, cooperative, you know, that's the only way that, that dairy farmers can prevail. Well, you know, look at Silver Fern Farms, look at Westland. They can fail, and they do.
Well, so what next? What next? What next for Fonterra, given that they are failing? I mean...
There has to be, I think, an insurgency. An insurgency at the shareholder level. You know, it's the property rights of the dairy farmers who choose to do business with Fonterra. I'm not going to trash their property rights. Their value has been trashed by Fonterra. Five people get over $1 million. A quarter of all the employees of Fonterra get over $100,000. But the people who own it have to take the responsibility to deal with it. I worry, however, about the degree to which New Zealand is on the wrong end of this equation. You know, what are we doing with these valuable resources which we know we've got to live within planetary limits? What the hell are we doing allowing a business model like this to prevail when it's so demonstrably going to take us to a race to the bottom?
Look, I mean, a race to the bottom in any industry is never a good thing. David, any further thoughts? Is there anything you want to add on this topic?
Oh, well, just what Ruth has just alluded to, that there's also an environmental aspect of this. And there's always people who say, well, you cannot have limitless economic growth on a finite planet. And I've always said that's simply not true. For the reason that you can make more and more valuable stuff out of the same resources. That's called technology. That's called innovation. But the Fonterra model has basically been to see how much land you could get into, how much intensity of production and ship how much milk powder burnt with, you know, how much coal and gas to burn it down, shipped to the other side of the world. I mean, if you're an environmentalist and people think you can't be a free marketeer like ACT people and be an environmentalist, actually, you can't be an environmentalist if you don't believe in markets and innovation and technologies getting better living standards and more growth out of the same resources. But Fonterra's model inherently is about growing by consuming more products at the same level of value. So, look, I think there's a really strong environmental story in this that often gets missed.
But here's a really scary thing. You know, in the first 8 years of Fonterra's existence, the farmers, and Pete Fraser uses this example, the farmers spent more on plastic ear tags for their cows than Fonterra retained by way of earnings to grow a business so it could innovate and thrive. Duh.
Wow. It's unbelievable. Okay. I'm just sort of trying to process that.
Yeah,
I mean, how much does a plastic ear tag? Do they have one in each ear? Just no?
Nate,
they're maybe like really. Are they like really fashionable ones?
You've got to track and trace? Ordinary all-flex tags,
You've seen many governments come and go. What's your take on the current one?
Well, this is what I thought swimming this morning. I do all my best analysis when I'm in chlorine. So swimming this morning, this is what I thought. This is a government that specialises in virtue signalling. This is a man that specialises in virtue substance. You look at the causes that David is advancing. The courageous cause of euthanasia, for example. The willingness to say to kids, you've got to get the best chance out of an education system, and therefore we're going to back choice in schools.
Mm.
You know, the willingness to argue for competition. Everybody's up and arm about petrol prices. What a surprise this week. We get an inquiry. What does it show? Where there's competition, the consumer is better off.
That's
what
right.
a surprise. Who's the man? Who's the voice for that? So we've got a government that specialises in virtue signalling, but I think the scales are falling from the eyes. The stardust belongs on the front cover of Vogue, but in fact, increasingly New Zealanders are saying, oi, mind the gap. That's the promise. What about the performance? You know, what's the performance on productivity? What's the performance on housing? What's the performance on education? What's the performance on health? If you're a bloke and you get prostate cancer, you are much more likely to die in New Zealand because it's on a waiting list than if you had a competitive system. So I think they're a rookie government. I think they're saved by the Fiscal Responsibility Act, which is the gift that keeps on giving. But they're either rookie, they don't know what they know, or they're rabid. Like, you know, the Minister of Education, you know, completely rabid about what has to be done. And, you know, you get an economic out downturn and all, you know, as Buffett said, you know, when the tide goes out.
Well, you know who's swimming naked.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks for your kind words, but can we talk a bit about you? Because the Fiscal Responsibility Act is the gift that
keeps
on giving. And in an incredible bit of petty pique, Michael Cullen.
If you could please give a layman's version of Fiscal Responsibility Act. What does it do? What does it stand for?
The very simple history, and I stand to be corrected, but Paul Ruth became the Minister of Finance in 1990, and what she didn't know is that the country was completely bankrupt. And in a way, there was a justice to it, because 6 years earlier, when the government changed, Muldoon had said to David Longy, we've got a surprise for you in the morning. So every time a government was elected, they didn't know what state the books were in. And the incentive for a politician was to basically run the country bankrupt or run the government bankrupt. And if you got through the next election, then you'd have to deal with it. But there was no incentive to actually run responsible books. And so there were two issues. One, the accounting was crap. And two, there was no requirement to actually publish it. And so what a combination of, you know, our founder, Roger Douglas, of the Public Finance Act, and Ruth, as the next finance minister with the Fiscal Responsibility Act, did, said, first of all, let's have the world's first totally inclusive accrual accounting. And I know people get bored about accounting, but it's really important that you can actually measure the all-in costs of what government's doing.
If you get that wrong, you'll find out pretty quick.
Look, in your business, you don't sort of lie to yourself about the figures and have but the government's did this for generations. So you know, Ruth, if it's possible for me to fangirl, I fangirl over Ruth, because Ruth fixed that, and Roger fixed that. But, of course, like a lot of things, if I say one thing about this government, I mean, they are great at marketing and they are weak on substance, I agree. But they do have, you know, it's a little bit superficial and misguided, we would say, but they do have a bit of reformist zeal. I mean, they do want to reopen debates about public accounting and have different types of accounting and so on. I mean, have you paid much attention to what they're proposing?
Yes, I think the wellbeing budget is all spin and no substance. Because how can you have a budget that says, I care about people's mental well-being, I will allocate $1.9 billion to fix it. So why are we doing it? We care about people's mental health. What are we doing? We're making an allocation. How are we doing it?
No idea.
Don't know. There's nothing allocated. Or children who are of special needs.
I'm coming to the defence of Jacinda here, because I think the well-being signal is actually, it's important. And I keep saying this. I think I mentioned this on an earlier podcast. It's the well-being of the productivity, the feeling people get from actually being active.
Who said that we weren't concerned about well-being?
Exactly.
It's nonsense. It's just some moral high ground. Let's look at how they actually deliver. If they were serious about well-being, they'd radically reform the education system, because that's how you break the cycle of disadvantage. If they were serious about well-being, we wouldn't let, you know, failed, clapped out individuals try and run hospital wards. for goodness sake, and then have to put in commissioners. So I won't have it. I won't yield high ground to those who say, you just say it's well-being and it happens.
Yeah.
So I think that there's, I commend reformist instincts. Yeah. I commend, it was the Greens who insisted on a budget responsibility rules.
Mm.
And so that's the responsible part of this government. But the idea that you can just have these airy-fairy worthy targets and not be held to account for delivering on them, I mean, the voters are not like that. Mm. Look at Kiwi Build. You know, it's magical, you're going to do this. We don't deliver. And the punters say, excuse me, we mind the gap. And this is a really big fail. But come back to this man.
But just while we're on the topic, because sort of related is this proposal this week that we're going to have a parliamentary budget office. So, you know, if you want to run for parliament, you've sort of got to go to parliament and get your ideas tested by parliamentary officials first. And I have a very strong view about this, but I'm curious to hear what you think.
No, where you go?
Well, I think it's an outrage. I mean, we send people to parliament to keep the government and the politicians under control.
Mm.
And the idea that your ideas have to go through the filter of the establishment before the people send you there,
yeah.
I mean, it's just a total misunderstanding. The people are sending their representatives to Wellington, not people that some Wellington institution has approved of.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, you know, I mean, Ruth has some war stories and she was a lot more effective than me, but you win an election, you get there, and actually, the bureaucrats are the enemy. You know, in doing charter schools, we had to get several Ministry of Education bureaucrats fired from their jobs for deliberately obstructing us.
Mm.
Now, you know, the idea that they have a go at you before you even get elected as well,
that's right,
is shocking. Yeah. So I'm completely opposed to this. Yeah, almost everyone else on the right's in favour.
All right, let's look. What's the gold standard? First of all, the ideas have to be gold standard. I mean, I first knew David, young guy, shiny suit. And he was a man of principle then, and he's a man of principle now. Yeah. He knows where his North Star is. So you have to know where the North Star is. What's going to guide your decision-making?
Mm.
Then you need to show performance. Mm. Then you need to show relevance. Are you actually intervening in a way that makes any sense? Is the proposed parliamentary budget office really relevant to how political parties and candidates and voters think about the equation when they go into the ballot box? And you have to have trust.
Yeah.
And every time there's a big fail, that's the issue that Fonterra faces. They are losing the trust of their shareholders.
That's right.
And same for politicians. Mm. You've got to perform. You've got to be relevant.
Yeah.
Public policy matters. It matters a lot to the kind of behavior. But in the end, you know, it's the scene setting. It's our spirit. It's our DNA. It's our innovative juices. It's our smarts. Yeah. They're going to make this country.
David, you're on a real winning what's the word? You're actually getting complimented quite a bit. In fact, talking to people out there, one thing that people always say, they're not sure about, and one thing I keep repeating to them, exactly what you said, Ruth, about the North Star and being consistent. You want to know about how to build trust? Be consistent. And I think sometimes that's almost a challenge that you have as ACT, is that you're going to be consistent on, say, for example, end-of-life choice. It's about giving people a choice and giving them the liberty and the freedom to make their own choice. Yet that's cost you, so I guess, you know, potentially or in the past, without them having a proper analysis of it, they've gone, oh, we're conservative, we're Christian, we do not want to get involved in this, and gone away at that. And I urge people out there, me personally, to actually look at it, because when you are going to be representing, I guess, all things to all people, very difficult to almost kind of say, oh, no, I represent just the conservative, or this sort of sector of the tribe. So, look, I commend you on that.
Look, it's people that make the difference. Public policy matters, but it's the actors, it's the people that make the difference. I've written on a power tool notepad, David Seymour. He brings courage, coherence, consistency, and clarity to the domain. And, you know, you rehabilitate politics, you get people like David being prepared to be in the domain.
Mm.
That's how you secure the powering up of New Zealand in every sense. So that's I'm right. Not for the stardust and well-being. I'm for powering us up. and performance.
Good policy, good results, and I think consistency is a critical thing. What advice do you have to the ACT Party?
It's a great time to mention that we have just opened our School of Practical Politics for the 2020 election cycle.
Good.
And so we've got a great course. We teach people about how to deal with the media and how to plan a campaign and how to answer a question and what our policy orientation is, because we actually want to, you know, we want to get some more people into Parliament. We want them to be good people, and we want to have representatives out there campaigning for us. We want them to know how to campaign, you know, efficiently and get our message across. So, look, people should sign up. We've already had about a dozen people in the first 2 days who, you know, want to sign up and maybe be ACT candidates. You can do that on our website, School of Practical Politics. And who knows?
Hopefully, I mean, you can put a link on the podcast.
I'm sure we can. And you too could have Ruth Richardson saying nice things about you.
That's something to aim for. Fantastic.
He's taking a leaf out of the Ukraine where I've worked. Had a big revolution, and then it all turned to custard because nobody did anything. So a guy who played an actor, the Prime Minister, the President, he got elected. Totally rookies. Everybody, never ever been there. The first thing he did was shove them all in a cold room and put them through the School of Practical Politics for a week. Good for him.
Well, that's outstanding. But it does show, I mean, part of the reason we're here as ACT is that people have become so disillusioned with their politicians. And personally, I just think, politicians in the West have said, look, you give us a third or half your income and we'll give you prosperity and a bit of social mobility. So, you know, basically everyone's going to be okay and anyone can make it. That's basically the deal. And people around the world are saying, well, hang on, this just hasn't worked. I mean, the people who really needed help haven't got help from the welfare state. The people who were going to do okay anyway did okay anyway. They just have to pay a third of their income in tax. And the higher the taxes, the more riotous people are. You look at France, I mean, they could go back to beheading people at any time. And they got a 75% tax rate and they're getting the same crappy results. But you made me think of it with the Ukrainians. I mean, they got so sick of their politicians that they took a comedian who played a fictional president in some Ukrainian TV drama and they elected him as the actual president. And I just think it's standing at a comedic level, but it also shows what happens if you don't deliver. And I hope that, you know, what ACT can do. I mean, I think we really did it with charter schools. That's what one ACT MP could do. So, our aspiration is that actually there's a whole lot of areas across the housing market. Kiwi Builds a joke. We've told people how you could do it better. Welfare dependency is terrible. I mean, prisons are a joke. I mean, you know, you've got people. Half the people there are back inside after 4 years. Now, how dumb do you have to be to have people who are like the ultimate captive audience? I mean, they literally cannot leave. And we do nothing to try and rehabilitate them, give them $320, send them on the way. By the way, don't go back to your old gang affiliates, commit crime and get sent back, which half of them do within 4 years. Yeah. So, you know, we could actually do so much better, but governments are such an underperforming sector. Takes too much, doesn't do enough, and people replace us with comedians. So, you know, that's mission.
Maybe that's the way. You should be taking this school it of comedy, you know, and have a TV show.
Maybe if since comedians are going to politics, politicians are going to comedy.
Turned into comedy.
Last thing to table. I've been very, because I've been an agent of change all of my life in politics and business in my own life. And I've been very taken, it's a Boston Consulting Group kind of construct, but it talks about head, heart and hands. Your head is what are the big rocks? What's your big ambition? You know what this guy's ambition is. I know what my ambition is for New Zealand. We live on the edge. We want to basically power ourselves up and you know, act in a way that secures, you know, huge premium return for our products. So that's the head. That's the big ambition. Your heart is, you know, have you got the right team on the bus? Have you got the right kind of strategy, you know, in order to deliver against that objective? And then hands is how you execute. Do you execute? Do you innovate with agility? The trouble is, if you have a look at so much of public policy, you know, the head is certainly, the heart may be there and the hands are bloody useless. They just shoot, mind the gap.
Right. Hey, so, Ruth, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much, Ruth. It's actually great. Absolutely wonderful. Pleasure to have you. Before we go, everyone, I just want to thank the team here at Podcast NZ, and we look forward to joining you again next week for another episode of Politics in Full Sentences. Good evening.
Evening.